I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Yeah, right. Crazy.
Hello, 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 and welcome to episode 166 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. This is being recorded on Monday the 28th of February, planning to come out on, I think, Friday the 4th of March, possibly Thursday the 3rd. That's if we're all still here and Cranky Bollocks Putin hasn't pressed that fucking button. Now, I'm not going to talk about Ukraine because there's absolutely nothing that I can add that you wouldn't have already heard. I just hope a resolution is found as soon as possible without too much bloodshed. And we can all get back to hating Boris again. Hey! But before we get there, as ever, thank you to our Patreon supporters, without whom we cannot create this podcast. You can help support the podcast from as little as £3 a month, which is about the price of a cup of coffee. And if you like what you're hearing, you can go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll find a drop-down box which will lead you to the Patreon link. Over there, as I say, you can support the podcast from as little as £3 per month. And if you're not able to do that, or you don't want to even, that's absolutely fine. This content is free for everyone. Well, a few months ago, when I was talking with my buddy Patrick Colquhoun, I did realise that I'd done hardly any episodes with potters and ceramicists. So I thought I'd change that and contact a couple of other ceramicists and potters that I know. I recorded with Carolyn Tripp and then saw that the Great Pottery Throwdown was about to come back on. So I contacted Keith Brimer-Jones, who appeared on episode 160, and if for whatever reason you're unaware, he is one of the judges on the Great Pottery Throwdown. After that was Carolyn Tripp on episode 161. I'm still waiting to confirm a date with Claire Partington. But this week we've got the second judge of the Great Pottery Throwdown, Mr. Rich Miller. Now, not only is Rich Miller an absolutely lovely guy, he's got an amazing backstory, which I'm not going to spoil here. And I should add, this was recorded on the windiest day in 30 years. And although you couldn't hear any interference, the phrase of "let's take the roof off" nearly come to fruition at Richie's end. Anyway, please come with me over Zoom into the studio, or pottery, of Mr. Rich Miller. But Rich, I have 7 questions that I ask every guest on the show.
Okay.
And the first being, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
I mean, that's quite a big question, because I guess, you know, my work falls into sort of several categories. I think, as it does for a lot of makers, you know, I think you speak to particularly ceramicists. They have fingers in lots of pies to kind of make a living. But, you know, I've been a yes to all man for way too long. So, yeah, and I've consequently ended up with a lot of different aspects of my work. So I'd say, you know, my day job is I run a company called Froyal Tiles, which is a sort of a handmade tile company. It was started by Rupert Spira back in the 80s. I've had it now for like 16, 17 years.
Nice.
And we make kind of handmade tiles to order. It was a small team. There's just myself and one other now. We've kind of grown smaller, which is actually because it kind of relieves some of the financial pressures of being an employer. But
is that due to technology as well?
No, I mean, you know, I think very quickly, you know, when I first took the company on, I was sort of 26. It was just a friend of mine said, oh, you know, there's a load of equipment going, you might want to sort of go over. I'm a bit of a magpie, you know, literally any opportunity to pick up an old bit of kit for next to nothing and I'm there. But, you know, it was a friend of mine said, go and have a look, you know, and I just went in and I fell in love with the products. You know, I was already a maker at that point.
Yeah.
I was making my own pots and stuff. And yeah, I just, you know, it wasn't ever about, you know, sort of making, I mean, I guess part of me in my mind was like, oh, I want to build this, you know, huge corporation, a massive, you know, thousands of square feet factory with a, but you know, the nature of ceramics and hand making, it's just not like that. You know, it's so reliant on people and skills. And, you know, so we've sort of remained small. At most, I had five people, you know, myself included. You know, we've just remained small over the years. So, you know, and it's kind of nice because it means we sort of remain flexible. You know, I feel lucky that I like the people that I work with. You know, kind of, you know, they've become sort of best friends over the years. And
good.
Yeah, you know, it's just the nature of the production. But we do a lot of collaboration work and we're fairly productive for what is a fairly small team. You know, and we're learning all the time. Every job that comes in is different.
Nice.
So, yeah, but it's very much the day job, you know. But I like the monotony of sort of making loads of stuff. I get lost in it, you know, like whether it's glazing thousands of tiles or hand pressing thousands of tiles. You know, I just love that kind of the production. You know, I think people often talk about that when they're makers. But, you know, I just find it's a good way of escaping. And now, you know, 16 years in, my mind wanders. I'm, you know, setting the world to rights in my mind while glazing, you know, tiles for Fired Earth sort of thing.
Well, the nature of handmade and hand glazed tiles, I could imagine that they've been for some quite interesting clients.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've worked with all sorts of people. You know, I did a wonderful collaboration with Kate Malone, architects for a building in Savile Row 4 or 5 years ago now. We've made tiles for the new pavilion at the Tate Gallery in St Ives.
Nice.
We do a lot of like restaurants, Nando's, Wagamama's. You know, it's all, we sort of fit that gap, I guess, where, you know, a designer might want something different or you know, we're restoring a house and it requires small numbers and the bigger factories wouldn't even look at it, probably because they're far too sensible to do so. you know, and so we pick up that kind of work, you know, and it's just, we've sort of fallen into a niche. You know, I had no great plans, you know, to sort of do anything particular to sustain the business. But, you know, I was lucky my folks sort of instill quite a strong work ethic and I love working, you know, and I love working with my hands, you know. So we've just kind of through sort of working and word of mouth and, you know, we've picked up some really lovely commissions.
Brilliant.
Over the years. And, you know, it just grows with time, I guess. You know, longevity in any kind of discipline, I think, really helps, you know, create sort of networks of people. And you know, and I love people. I love working with people. I love sort of collaborating. And, you know, we often offer sort of capacity if there's a maker who's picked up a job that's perhaps more commercial, but that kind of client might like their, I don't know, like their style or whatever they do. And so we act as their capacity. So they come in and make with us. And,
nice.
You know, so there's been lots of really interesting projects over the years that have just seemed to have sprung up from nowhere, you know. And, you know, my mum's always been like, you know, you never know what's around the corner. And it's been quite true. you just don't, do you? You don't know what conversation might lead to what, you know.
So did you intend to start the tile business when you went to look at the machinery?
No. And it was literally, I went to look at the kit. It was due to close at Christmas. And I went in on about the 19th of December. And I was just like, wow, this is incredible. You know, is there any possibility of carrying it on? And bless him, Keith, a guy called Keith Bramley, who was a farm worker who'd been running it for about 10 years. you know, he was due to retire at Christmas. He'd had one knee replaced and he was about to have the other one. And but he was just such a lovely soul, you know, such a nice person. And he just, you know, he'd grafted for 10 years and he was just grateful to see it continue. And, you know, it was all of the equipment was, you know, old equipment, you know. Yeah. So we had a pug mill from the late 1800s, you know, gas Brilliant. Kiln that was sort of 80 years old, and you had to kind of polish one piece of glass, you know, turn around, spit over your shoulder, and, you know, to make it work. It was one of those, you know, it had all of its own nuances. And he just gave me time, you know. He came in, I stepped in, so then, you know, the new year, January, I went in and I was literally left to my own devices. It was like, there you go. And yeah, I'd regularly destroy, you know, thousands of cars. It was, you know, it was, yeah, it was quite a formative period, I guess, you know. I mean, it was, yeah, it wasn't always easy. But then what in life ever is, you
of
know?
Course.
I mean, we all have our struggles, don't we? And it was nice, you know. They were known already, so it was just a matter of kind of picking up where sort of Keith had left off and then sort of building on it, really.
Does any of the old kit survive?
Yeah, we still use all of it, yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Apart from the gas kiln, which I dismantled and put into a wood kiln. Yeah, that's the only thing that, yeah, I don't see anymore. But yeah, we still use it, and the processes are the same. And, you know, we've moved a couple of times since. It's all good. So that's kind of, I guess, yeah, my day job.
Nice.
And then I've got sort of my own work, which has always sort of been bubbling in the background, which I guess, you know, I only really ever took the tiles on to fund my own own making, really, you know, to act as my bread and butter. And that's sort of mainly sort of domestic pots, sculptural work. And it's based around, I guess, sort of personal experiences, family history, all of that, really. Yeah, which is, you know, which I'm still unpacking, you know. It's I think it's one of those things that is always moving and always changing and always learning, you know.
Did you fall into the world of ceramics?
It's an interesting one, you know. I don't think I had that like epiphany moment that a lot of people have with clay, but I think, you know, the creative industries, I mean, you know, art on the whole probably saved me, you know. I found I had a tough childhood, you know. I spent most of my days happy. But, you know, I was in a really sort of rural place, you know, village in West Sussex. And you know, I looked very different to everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you sort of you know, yeah, it was just challenging, because, you know, I was sort of like, I suffered a lot of racism. And at the time, when you're a kid, you don't really kind of, you know, have the knowledge to sort of process that. And, you know, I just felt quite isolated and quite, you know, and you often sort of, I think my dad, you know, my dad was in the military. So he's very institutionalized from a very young age. You know, he went in at 15, probably saved his life too. But, but, you know, when he came out, he suffered with issues with alcohol. And, you know, we just had a really, it was, you know, I felt loved, which I think above all else, you know, made life okay. But it was just, yeah, you know, people often say, oh, you know, kids are brutal, you know. I was chubby, I was tall, I had glasses. And but I think the difference I found as a kid was, you know, it wasn't just coming from other kids, it was coming from the adults around me, you know.
Yeah.
It was and it wasn't until society told me that I wasn't allowed to be here or didn't fit in that I realized that, you know. I was just a kid, I was you know, enjoying what kids enjoy. You know, it was everybody else that was telling me there was, you know, I was less than human, you know. And I've just been kind of you know, trying to sort of educate myself really about why that is. And, you know, and I use my work, I think, to have, you know, the voice that I felt, you know, not until my late 30s, you know, I didn't feel comfortable talking about it probably till my late 30s, really. You know, because you know, my dad was always like, you know, he came in the early 60s and his dad came in the late 50s. And my dad was always just like, get on with it. Don't be one of those people with a chip on your shoulder. Just, you know, just get on in life. You know, treat people how you want to be treated and don't cause...
Yeah, that doesn't always work though, does it?
But that's it, you know. Yeah, that's it, exactly, you know.
That's all right as long as everyone else has got that same attitude, isn't
yes, it? Yes, exactly. You know, and all that stuff, as I say, it wasn't coming from me. So I found it quite difficult, you know. And I still, you know, you see the same cycles perpetuating themselves now. Do you know what I mean? I often think about when I was a little kid with my nan. So my mum's from rural North Wales, like grew up in a really kind of a sort of cob house. They made all their own clothes. You know, she was a real maker. My dad similarly had, you know, similar sort of experience in South America, in Guyana. You know, I often find that it's sort of, yeah, there's such parallels actually between their experiences. But, you know, they had very, very different experience in the UK. But I'll say, you know, I didn't feel strong enough to talk about it, I guess. And I found art a way of kind of exploring ideas and thoughts. And it's almost like I could make it, and the idea and the thought was documented and permanent. But I didn't have to say it, you know, it was something that, you know, and it always kind of creates conversation.
Yeah, well, that's the ideal thing with creatives. You're able, like you just said, you're able to express what you feel without having to sort of put your head above the parapet in front of everyone and sort of say it. And more the fact, you're sort of doing it silently. You haven't got to answer any questions. You've only got to ask the questions, you know.
That's it. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think the lovely thing about creative people generally is, you know, they're just interested in engaging with people and work and ideas. And like, you know, when I went to college, I left school, and as I say, school was very tough because I was, you know, the only black male in a school of 1,000 kids, you know, and it was tough. There was a lot of military kids in that area, and you know, a lot of traveller families, and so it was just a really sort of you know, I didn't get a good education because I just spent my time trying to survive, really.
Yeah.
I think when I got into college to do art, it was the first time I didn't feel like, you know, I was being judged based around the way I looked. You know, I was free to kind of explore what I wanted to explore and do what I wanted to do, you know, and people were interested in that more than they were who I was. They didn't care, you know, and everybody was different.
It's pretty amazing that people come out the other side with all their faculties, isn't it? After living several years like that, you know, the most formative years.
Yeah, but you know, I just feel lucky that I'm here talking to you. You know, if things had gone differently, it could be a very different story. You know, I mean, as I say, my mum's mum lived in Ruislip, so we used to travel up to Ruislip every month. We'd go up on the train, and you know, I remember sometimes we'd clash with the football. You know, if the football was on, and that was just, you know, I remember I must have been about 6 or 7 because I remember it. It was one of my earliest memories. And we got on this train. It was absolutely rammed with football fans. And my mum was, you know, holding my hand as if, you know, I'm not letting go sort of thing. And I remember this guy, he was a bit drunk, whatever, you know, and he came up and he's like, "What the F are you doing with this little wog? Where are you taking me? What's going on?" And blah, blah, blah. And started pushing me and my mum around, you know, like, what, you know, it was quite really, really aggressive, you know. Anyway, so consequently, sort of beyond that, couple of months, you know, somebody give me one of those little like Swiss Army knives with my name on it, you know, back in the sort of 90s sort of thing. And I remember, you know, I'd sort of put that in my pocket and take it with me, you know, and I thought, right, if anybody messes with me or my mum, I'm going to look after us sort of thing. And I just think, you know, it's
I wouldn't have done, mate, isn't it?
It's, but you know, yeah, that's it, you know, and had that situation arisen, I could have got into real trouble because I didn't know what I was doing. I was a kid, I was just scared. And I think, you know, a lot of the kids that are on the streets and, you know, carrying knives, carrying weapons, it's that same fear, you know.
Self-preservation, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's fear of their situation. And, you know, I'm, you know, rather them than me, you know, and you just think that whole cycle just kind of perpetuates itself. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's still a lot of fear out there, you know, of whether it's kind of fear of your other peers or gangs or whatever it might be. But, you know, and I think certain aspects of society become more divided, certainly, you know, since when I was a kid. But yeah, you just feel really lucky because I've encountered really lovely people, you know, in the field that I'm in. And I've sort of, you know, my path has kind of woven its way in such a way that, I can still make stuff. I'm here talking to you. And
you started an art course at college.
Yeah, I didn't get particularly good exam results, so I went into the sort of GMVQ program. which was amazing because it was just like full-time art, you know. I never, you know, I always wanted to go every morning. I was the first one there. I was the last one to leave. It was the same at uni, you know. I then went to do a ceramics degree at Farnham. And that was just mind-blowing, you know what I mean? Because you had everybody there, you know, different genders, different races, you know, everything, age groups, you know, you just encountered everybody. And, you know, so I went to do ceramics degree and, and I've just been making since. I just, you know, I just love, as I say, getting lost in process, in making stuff. And that hasn't changed, you know. So I go from making tiles all day at the workshop here to going home, and I've got a little shed and I just make work all evening. I just feel lucky that I'm able to make a living from doing that, you know.
When did you start looking at colonialism in your work?
So, again, you know, I guess it's partly due to that kind of unpacking of my sort of experiences growing up, because my dad, as I say, he was in the Marines. He went in doing as a bandsman, you know, as a musician. He loved music, but he couldn't. His dad died of cancer when he was 12. At 15, you know, just to earn a living, they came over to this country. Within a couple of years, his dad passed away. He went into the military, but you know, he was fiercely proud of his military career, you know. And in the 30 years he was in, he earned respect, which I think meant a lot to him. And he met royals, and you know, so around the house, you know, we had a lot of like his hat pin badges, a lot of you know, the photos of him meeting Princess Anne and all these things.
Yeah.
So, you know, the royal family were always, you know, I felt quite proud to be British and proud to have an institution like the royal family. You know, and it's only sort of through learning about, as I say, sort of colonial, educating myself about British history. You know, as I would hope anybody British would be interested in, that I've sort of learned more about, you know, how I've ended up here, I guess. And so, yeah, I just find the whole thing fascinating, you know, because it's shaped the world we live in, you know, Britain's kind of legacy, you know, and for such a small island to be on such a world stage as it has been over the years, you know, it's shaped the country we live in, and certainly shaped some of the experiences I've had living in it. You know, my dad was from Guyana in South America. It was a British colony up until 66. You know, Guyana being given back to it was slightly overshadowed by the World Cup. So it's kind of, I guess it started out feeling like it was trying to figure out why I had a right to be here, because I've been told for so many years that I didn't, and it's just turned into sort of a realization that it's actually, broadly speaking, just, you know, it touches everybody that lives here in this country, and it's such an important part of our history that, you know, didn't know anything about, really. And so it's just been, as I say, it's been an education for myself that I felt I missed out on, you know. I mean, we did Roots at school. We did, you know, we watched the television adaptation when I was about 12, and then for the next sort of 6 months to a year, I got called Kunta Kente, which wasn't that pleasant.
How old are you, can I ask?
I'm 40 now.
Yeah,
just turned 40 this year.
Do I remember when Roots came on when I was a kid? Yeah, I remember it coming on. Because I was so young, I just saw black people outside. I didn't realise how they got there. Yeah, I thought they just moved there, you know, when I was that young.
That's it,
sort of watch that. And because you watch it weekly, and it was quite a long series from what I can remember. And week by week, you know, you sort of, oh, hold on a minute. There's like a small realisation of how some of the people that I see outside my window could have got to this country, you know.
Yeah, this is it, you know. And I think, you know, I didn't have a, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, have a sense of black culture. I didn't have a black culture, you know. I often, you know, I laugh about it with my wife because, you know, if I go into a crowded pub and, you know, there's a black guy, I'm like, oh, there's a black guy.
Solidarity over in the corner.
Me thinking the same thing, you know, whereas if it's a pub full of white people, it's just, you know, because I didn't have, growing up, I didn't have any kind of black culture or any sense of like, you know, I was just inside my eyes looking out. So I didn't see anybody black. I didn't, you know, have any black community or, you know, my dad was away, you know, a lot of people, when we first moved into the village we lived in, when I was two, you know, thought I was adopted because my mum is white and, you know, I was a little black kid and they just thought I was a little adopted child, you know. So I sort of, I didn't have that kind of, so, you know, and then school didn't provide that, you know, because it was a curriculum based around sort of, I guess, a kind of a whitewashing of the whole. And I loved history, you know, I loved history. And I just think, you know, I just think it's sad that just sensible conversation isn't encouraged, because I think, you know, you seem to get these sort of, this polarization and these extreme views that just become so divisive. It would just be lovely if we could all just talk about it, because you know, it wasn't going to change my situation, but it just would have been nice to have felt like conversation was okay, you know.
Well, it's starting to happen now in schools, isn't it, you know? And we had an artist on here a few months ago called Lisa Vandy, and she come from your area. Or further down, I think it was down near Brighton. It was West Sussex anyway.
Yeah.
And she was adopted into a white family.
Yeah.
She didn't realise that she was any different from her mum and dad. And she was a few years older than me, if she doesn't mind me saying that. But she was getting pointed at in the street and people were calling her mum out, you know, asking what that is in the pram sort of thing, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can definitely relate to those sorts of experiences, you know. And it makes you very fearful, you know, fearful of life, you know, I think. You know, I often talk to actually my wife about it, because she sort of says, you know, growing up as a female, and walking the streets at night or walking the streets in the day alone, and, you know, that sense of feeling like she's being watched or she's being, you know, I mean, for obvious, very, very different reasons. But I had that same sense that, you know, because I didn't belong, I was fearful of, you know, the repercussions of being out on my own late at night, you know, until I was in my teens, and then I just got, you know, drunk, just got pissed and didn't care. But,
of course.
You know, I just think, you know, I think it's one of those things. It's I sort of almost feel ashamed that I have to be talking about it into my 40s. But, you know, it's just, it is getting better. And I've got a daughter who's six now, and she's at school. And although she's aware of the colour of her skin, you know, so far she's not had any of the negative aspects. You know, I had teachers at school calling me names, you know, and it was horrendous, you know. But I didn't understand, you know, at the time.
And
but
saying it was a different time doesn't really cut it, does it, you know?
No. And you know, to be fair, it was, you know, it was.
I mean, in the early 90s, I used to have a security firm. We used to put like doormen in clubs and that. And we had a small club in Holborn, and this one club had two brothers on it who were black guys. And I've gone down to sort of pay the wages, and we've gone downstairs and gone in for a drink. And it was called a ragga night. It was like the young black guys. And it was, as I've gone in, and like we're sitting in there having a drink, just standing in the corner, my mate Junior said, "How's it feel being the only white person in here?" And I looked around, I went, "Fucking hell, I am." And I said, "That doesn't happen often." He went, "You get used to it after a couple of hundred years." Okay.
But, it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was having a chat with a friend of mine. And I said to him, "How often do you leave the house and you know, walk down the road and think about the colour of your skin, you know, and what
mad,
you might think of that?" And he's like, "What are you talking about? That I've never ever thought that." And it's like, that's like every day, you know. Yeah. You just it's bizarre. And I get, you know, there's that whole that old saying, isn't there? The you know, you don't know a person until you walk a mile in, you know, in their shoes, or you know, and you know, try walking in their shoes for 40 years and then you'll know what it's like to be someone. Do you know what I mean? We can't, none of us can understand what our own sort of lived experiences are. And so I just, you know, but I guess it's shaped everything I do now, to a degree, but, and I'm just still learning, still exploring those themes.
And because this is audio and people may not have seen your work, could you explain how you show that in your work?
So I guess my first sort of route into that was creating kind of blue and white tiled pieces, and that was mainly because, I mean, where my family were from in Guyana, they were on the Demerara River, and so, you know, Demerara, the river Demerara was producing sort of some of the most high-end sugar back in the day. And consequently, a lot of slaves were brought over to kind of farm that. But it was also fighting a lot between the British and the Dutch, because it had a kind of an inland port where they could kind of load the ships, you know, deposit slaves and pick up the sugar, because it's got a sort of 70-mile inland channel. I liked with that blue and white how, you know, as a style, a decorative style, it could be so synonymous with a single place. You know, everybody looks at what I make and they're like, oh, Delft, you know, blue and white.
Yeah.
And yes, it is. But, you know, it's also been Chinese. It's also been, you know, Japanese. It's also been English, you know, British. You know, it's just sort of, it's one of those styles that actually has traveled the world with people. You know, cobalt was a precious commodity and associated with kind of fine quality wares. But, you know, the blue and white tiles would often have kind of narratives sort of woven into them, and they would either be like the religious affiliation of the family that commissioned them, or they'd be something to do with that family's history. And it was always affluent kind of individuals who commissioned them. And I guess it was as much, you know, so I make sort of, I throw vessels and I emboss them, and then I sort of put little images which are kind of associated with my family history, kind of British history I've been learning, and it's as much about sort of putting a marker in the sand and sort of saying, you know, I've been here, you know, this is my experience. You know, some might say it's slightly narcissistic, I guess, you know, but it's that sort of
that's what it's.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. It's that unashamed kind of voicing of who I am. And you know, I love the permanence of ceramics, the fact that we are learning about ancient civilizations from the things they made and the things they used. And so, yeah, and it's sort of moving on. So I've now sort of started incorporating kind of toys from when I was young and just playing, you know, because I think, you know, play when I was young was so important. You know, I was still, when I was, you know, 15, 16, I'd my release would be playing Lego, or, you know, I was stuck in a space where, you know, I just play would kind of free me from what was going on outside.
So, and when did you start incorporating that? Recently?
Yeah, so that's more recently. Yeah, I'm hoping to have a show in the summer. And there's a lot of new work, you know, that some of which has been sort of, a long time coming. But yeah, you know.
So I would you say that your work up until recently, you've been trying to sort of show what you are, and now you're showing who you are?
Absolutely. I think, you know, as you get older, you just start to sort of feel more confident or less ashamed, you know, of sort of, and you don't worry about if people find things you do offensive. Obviously, I mean, you know, you don't want to make people feel bad, but I think it's okay for people to be offended. You're allowed to be offended. You know, I feel like I spent the first, you know, 20 years of my life feeling offense, you know, at the things that were said and done to me, you know, and so actually I feel, you know, it's only now that I feel brave enough. And I feel, you know, having a daughter, it makes you feel, having a child, you know, you feel a different sense, you know, you feel an obligation to make sure that these conversations are had in the hope that things do change for the better. And like you said earlier, I think they have, you know, I agree. I think things have got a lot better. I just hope that conversation continues. Conversation and education, I just feel, are like the root out of everything for everybody, you know, because.
And isn't it great that you can do that silently just by a visual? you know, by a cup that someone can hold in their hand, or an urn that you can look at, a painting on the wall, whatever it is.
Absolutely. And I feel like actually, you know, the throwdown, you know, as well is me doing that too. You know, I feel
How
like.
How did you get involved in that?
So that was it's just by chance, you know. So when the programme started back in 2015, they were kind of looking around at sort of various options for judges, various options for kind of contestants and stuff like that. And a lovely producer, Karen Richardson, came down because they were talking about having like one main judge. And I think, you know, like visiting judges, depending on what the challenge was.
Yeah.
And they were talking about tiles, and a few people had said, you know, the ceramics world is tiny. You know, if you know, it's a really, really small community. And they were thinking about tiles, and they said, oh, you know, a few people said go and talk to Rich. And so they did screen tests and all that sort of thing. Then they changed the format, and they got, you know, two regular judges. And they sort of said, would you be interested in coming to sort of do technicianing and some of the kind of technical stuff? Because, you know, I do a bit of hand building, you know, I've got quite a broad range of skills, I guess. But yeah, so I got kind of involved that way, really. And then, you know, after the first year, which was literally mind-blowing, you know, I'd never ever experienced anything like the TV world. It's and apparently first series of anything are always notoriously difficult, because everybody's learning about the process of making this show, and, you know, fitting ceramics into.
Well, it's starting with no foundation, isn't it? It's just a load of ideas that all of a sudden become real.
Yeah, absolutely. Treading completely new ground, you know. And then I sort of got more and more involved. So, you know, Kevin Millward, who designs all the challenges on there, is just this incredible oracle of all things clay. You know, he's just mind-blowing, and spending time with him was just incredible. I knew him anyway, you know. And then you know, over the years I started sort of getting involved with the auditioning process, finding the potters, you know, writing the challenges, you know. And then I was just looking after the work, you know, for the first three series. So I was processing all of the potters' makes while they were away, it wasn't until sort of two series ago that the then series producer Sarah Thompson Willey sort of said, would you be interested in judging? And it wasn't ever on my radar, you know, at all. But I was just, I was a bit blown away by the whole idea. I still am, because I got into ceramics, I guess, out of passion and just the love of being lost in the process, you know, and that hasn't changed, you know. And then so to have that kind of recognition was just unreal, really.
And Keith's good fun to work alongside, I suppose, isn't he?
Yeah, he's mad. I mean, you know, he's got a story, you know. Well, he's never going to run out of stories, you know. I keep, because he's obviously released his book, I keep telling, joking with him, saying I'm going to release a book called Stories from the Green Room, you know, the after hours version. Because I tell you what, he's certainly led a colourful life.
Yeah, he's good fun.
Yeah.
I suppose there's always the danger working with Keith that some of the unfired stuff could turn to slip with the tears.
there is always that. No, he's an incredible guy, you know. I think he's had a really interesting life, and it's a pleasure working with him, as it is everybody, you know. Everybody on the show over the years, people come back and they've just become like family, you know. All the guys that work the cameras, the producers, everybody, the runners, you know, everybody's just so lovely, you know. And it's just this wonderful, joyous kind of few months, you know. You get picked up out of your normal life and dropped into this, you know, this environment where you've got all these brave potters that are putting themselves out there making this stuff, and, you know, camera guys spending hours and hours just like in the zoned in, you know, like it, and you just sort of make this thing together. It's incredibly, you know, I feel incredibly lucky to be.
Well, the feel of watching the program, it is as if the feeling of the process emanates, you know, because it's a very calming and soothing thing to watch. I've not done much with clay. I've made a few little pots, been on the wheel a couple of times. And as I said to Keith, I've got an ashtray outside that was meant to be a little tankard, but it's just an ashtray now, you know, because it was only the base that survived. But I've got a few little pots and stuff kicking around still, but what a beautiful process it is. I always say to people that that haven't really created much before. Let's just have a go at ceramics because or throwing, because although it is a pain in the backside trying to sort of, you're just putting a bit of clay in the middle of a wheel that's moving. It shouldn't be that bloody difficult. But as soon as you sort of, bit of pleasure you get from actually making something out of a bit of bloody mud, more or less, you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it? You know, it is mud, and you just don't, I think you don't have to come to it feeling precious, you know, because it is just a lump of mud, and it can be infinitely recycled until it's fired, you know, and yet once it is fired, then it's like permanent, you know, that ashtray, people are going to be digging up in 2000 years saying, oh, you know, what was that maker thinking when he made this, you know, but I just, you know, as they will with a lot of the things I made when I was first starting out, but, you know, it's yeah, there is something about the material, you know, and I think, and our connection as people to it, you know, that goes back thousands of years that you can't get around, you know, it's just, there's just something about it, you know, yeah, the tactile qualities, the just the, you know, and that transformative element, you know, from that bag of mud, that inanimate just lump of whatever, through to, you know, something that's fired that will be here forever, just, you know, and you can, you know, drink from or eat from or smoke into, or, you know, there's so many, just so many possibilities, you know. And
there's something about having an object or an item that has got been made by hand, got fingerprints in it, you know.
Yeah.
There's something about that. There's always that human connection to that item, isn't
definitely,
there?
Definitely, definitely. You know, I went mudlarking a few weeks back, really? You know, on the Thames, and you're just like, you know, you've got a thumbprint in a Roman pot. You're just like, that is that maker's thumbprint, you know, and it's just, yeah, it is such a direct connection, like you said.
Did you go with a mudlarker, or was you just walking along the shore?
So actually it's a project I'm working on with Mike Webber, who's from the London Museum. He's an archaeologist, and you know, you pick up what looks like a random pebble, and he will tell you where that's from, why it's in,
because they've got eyes like eagles, haven't they, walking along the shore.
Yeah, you've got to get your eye in, and they're just, you know, it's just that, it's just filling in all that social history and that, you know, that behind all these things, that's just so, so fascinating, you know.
I mean, it sounds like I was aware that you've got this coming up, but did you say that was a book or a TV programme?
It's not either, actually.
Oh,
it's
sorry.
It's just a project that I'm working on with an organisation, I guess, a London-based organisation. And it sort of revolves around kind of, sort of finds on the Thames and that kind of social history and things. So, which, you know, I find fascinating anyway. I love history, social history. I just love the fact that, you know, I guess we are living history, because everything, you know, history informs where we are now, but it's not, you know, you can't really plan the future, but what we're doing now does inform the future. But I love looking back and seeing, you know, why now is what it is because of what's gone before, you know, and those remnants that are left, you know, to kind of learn from, find them fascinating.
And it sort of marks what's next down the road as well, doesn't it, you know?
And yeah, exactly. And how things just go in cycles, and how, it, you know, we're all sort of living sort of versions of what was, you know, everybody sort of looking back with sort of rose tinted glasses, and you know, that kind of things aren't, you know, they're not like they used to be, you know, things used to be much better, and you think, God, you know, we're actually in a pretty good situation now, you know, aside from obviously the pandemic, you know, a lot of people live through sort of health issues that would have killed them, you know, only a matter of 100 years ago, you know, most people are clothed, you know, have a house and can afford to eat, although that's not always easy, I think, you know. But, you know, I think, broadly speaking, society has progressed.
Rich, if there was you and five other artists or makers, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
Wow. Okay, that's an interesting one. Well, I mean, one would almost certainly be Magdalene Adundo, who is my teacher at Farnham. Wow, you know, I just sort of looking back, I don't think I fully appreciated quite how lucky I was, firstly, to have her as my tutor, but secondly, you know, at the point at which I was in my career, to go into a situation where she was sort of in a prominent role, now Dame Magdalene Adundo, obviously, but you know, seeing someone Black in that kind of role was instrumental to building my own confidence. And her work is just out of this world. I mean, the quality and the kind of energy in it is incredible. I really like, there's an artist called Junko Nico who makes very large scale kind of ceramic pieces, and will often kind of create these pieces in spaces that they can't be taken out of, and then sort of smash them to bits to remove them. And but kind
like
of monumental, sort of a monumental scale, which I really love. So I'd say they would have to be in there. I mean, I would love to kind of incorporate maybe someone like Bob Marley. I know, obviously not around, but you know, I think music and sound. You know, I love sound art. And I just think, you know, I often wonder whether he'd be doing something more conceptual or more, you know, because he was always sort of an activist, an undercover activist in a sense, you know. I mean, putting out these words, incredible words and music that's sort of as relevant now as it was, definitely, you know, when I was listening to it in the late 80s. So I'd probably want to have maybe Bob, if this is like the complete and utter, you know, anything, you know, I would say, yeah, I'd have to have Bob Marley in there, just to provide the soundscape. I'd say someone like Chris Ofili, who I've admired for years and years. I went to the Sensations exhibition in the 90s, and apart from the fact I was kind of still in my late teenage years, and you know, it was very provocative, very kind of interesting artwork. I just loved the mix of Chris Ofili's work, where he had the kind of the very traditional process that he then brought forward and used in a way that he kind of discussed much more contemporary.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm at. That's what's that? Three.
Four.
Four. Is that four already?
Yeah.
God. who else? I think probably one of the sort of wood-fired contingents. I mean, maybe someone like Sven Beyer, who's a wood-firer, makes the most incredible, or did, you know, he's sort of retired now. But as a student, I went to see his workshop and space. And he just, you know, the order and the structure that he worked with, and the kind of the attention to detail in the process that he had. These, you know, made the most beautiful, beautiful pots. And it's that kind of order and structure that I admire and strive for, but never seem to achieve in anything I do when it comes to a lot of things. But, you know, so he'd have to be in there, because I'd just love to look at his work.
I could
touch it and look at it all day long. It would be quite an interesting mixed show, you know, from the traditional. I guess it's where I sit. You know, I love the traditional stuff. I love really kind of provocative contemporary work as well. But yeah, I think those would probably be amongst my top five.
When I've seen artists like that, I look at their practice and it's so perfect in my eyes. It can go one of two ways. It even makes you want to work harder. It inspires you to go that route. Or sometimes you just go, I'm never going to get that. why am I doing this? If that's the level, you know, if that's the top rung, you know, it's miles away from the one I'm on, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm completely with you. You know, I suffer big time from imposter syndrome, you know. And you know, you look at what everybody else is doing, you just think, why bother? But then, you know, if you don't bother, what else are you going to do?
What I've said on here, Rich, so many times is I'm quite sure now that the only ones that don't get imposter syndromes are the imposters, you know.
Right. Okay.
We've all got it, no matter what rung you're on, you know. Everyone thinks they've done it on the sort of seat of their pants, you know.
That's right. Yeah. You just think, you know, somebody's going to find. I quite often thought that on the throwdown. You know, I'm there talking about whatever, and it's like you know, you're kind of looking over. Somebody's going to find me out sometime. Realise that, you know, they weren't meant to invite me here. You know. It's completely bizarre, isn't it? It's completely bizarre. Okay.
So I discovered art in prison.
Wow. Okay.
I was doing a drug sentence. So I was in during Sensations. I saw the Sensation catalogue. Bang, that's where I wanted to go. And I wrote to all the artists in it.
Wow.
I sent 32 letters out. Out of that 32, I got 28 back.
Wow. Oh my God.
They sort of pushed me through towards getting my degree on release, like several years later. Which is, you know, when you said Sensations, that's why a big grin came on my face, because that was my turning point.
Yeah, I just felt like it was a turning point for me too, you know. I mean, just in terms of that provocative nature, artists, you know, it just made me understand what art was for.
Yeah.
You know,
And which... Yinka Shinabari's work as well, which, it, you know, it doesn't look anything like yours, but it's got essence of the same thing. He's bringing in colonialism and looking back to its African roots, you know?
Yeah.
Or his African roots, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I went to see Yinka's show at the Tate a couple of years back. I mean, yeah, I just think, you know, and I think that the lovely thing about, you know, I mean, I guess any other discipline, you write to 30 people involved in a situation that, you know, you probably wouldn't get a response. But I think artists, it's that sharing, it's the community, it's that sense that, you know, it's good to talk.
It was those guys that sort of just decided to write back, and writing a letter nowadays isn't, you know, it's an email now. You've got to give time to a letter, haven't you, you know? And they sent me through catalogues, letters, and just so much stuff. Yeah, and it changed my life, and I owe everything to those artists that wrote to me, you know.
Yeah. And to prison, I mean, are people in prison still, do they have access to kind of creativity, to art? I mean, is that something that's still...
The creativity side... it's diminishing now. There's a charity that I'm on the board of, a trustee of, called Kersler Arts.
Right.
And each year they put a massive exhibition on at the Royal Festival Hall, which this year is going to be curated by Ai Weiwei.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. And just gone, it was curated, the last one in November was curated by, do you know the designer Camille Walloa?
Wow, yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah, so she curated it this year. And we get art from every prison in the country, and put on this massive exhibition. Curators have been like Sarah Lucas, Grayson Perry.
Wow.
And likewise, incredible. I mean, I'm giving all the big names. Likewise, it's been prisoners' families that have curated the show as well.
Wow.
You know?
God, how interesting. Somebody will relate to what you've made, you know, and if they don't, then they'll be educated by it, and that might make them relate to it and understand your situation a bit more. Because I just feel, you know, genuinely, I feel that's where the divisive aspects of society have sort of been born from, is that lack of desire to just kind of be educated and engage in conversations that are outside of your norm, you know, whether that's with someone who's in prison or coming out of prison, or whether that's someone who's from a different ethnic background or has a different gender to you, or, you know, I just feel like we need that kind of ability to talk and find the relatable aspects of all of our experiences, you know.
If you wasn't a maker, a ceramicist, or whatever label you put on yourself, what would you like to be, do you think, if you didn't have the caps you wear?
I definitely think, had I not been doing ceramics, it would have been archaeology, history, or, you know, and I definitely wouldn't be at the front end. As I say, I didn't get a particularly good education, so I'd probably be the person, you know, grubbing about in the hole as part of the time team type of group, you know, just finding all these bits of interesting things, or, you know, or maybe some kind of hoarder next door. You know, I'd probably buy a field somewhere and just fill it with random bits of stuff. Brilliant. You know, I'd probably use one day, or I don't know, or you know, I mean, I would love to have been an engineer, you know. If I'd have been more academic, I would have loved to have done, because I love building things. You know, I encourage my daughter to make all sorts of different things, you know, sort of living my desires there through her. But, you know, maybe engineering, something like that. You know, I think it definitely would have always been making or building, or you know, maybe even a builder, something like that. You know, I love building stuff, and I love skills, you know, I love learning new skills, you know, and much of what I do, whether it's my own work or the tiles or whatever, you know, it's about kind of, it's about skills. You know, I also run an arts a festival, a ceramics festival every year in November at Farnham, you know, and we get, you know, we select from, you know, lots of applications, but it's all about, you know, different processes and different approaches and different work and different people. And so I think, I would have been doing something that involved a making process of some sort, and ideally people, because I love people, you know.
Perfect.
I was an only child, so I just, you know, I was kind of lost in my own head for a lot of my childhood. So the more I can sort of share thoughts and ideas with other people, and, you know, and get that back, the better, really.
Brilliant. Lastly, where can people find what you do, be it online or social media, website?
Yeah, good question. I always want to be better at social media. I'd like to say, you know, I use Instagram. I found sort of some of the other platforms quite difficult. I think that kind of that idea that you're sort of you have anonymity online sort of worries me slightly because I think everybody's a critic. I don't know if everybody's a critic. I found actually the feedback online is on social has been incredibly encouraging on the whole. But yeah, I use Instagram because I feel like it's quite positive. A lot of creative people use it. And on the whole, it's sharing of interesting images, things that matter to people.
And what's your handle on there?
I'm at Rich Miller Potts. Yeah. So I use that. And then other than that, you know, anybody is welcome at the workshop here anytime. You know, I spend all day every day, well, bar the weekends now, at the workshop in Surrey. So I'm either making tiles or making my own work here. I'm planning, as I say, some more shows. I've just been flat out busy, you know. We moved workshops a year ago, so I've been literally building the place, you know, learning to weld and building doors and mezzanines and but we're getting to the stage where I'm hoping I can open the doors up and invite people in, because the space was designed around inviting people in, and I'm hopeful that we'll get lots of visitors, you know. So I'd say the workshop here in Surrey, people are always welcome.
Well, you're saying that you know, you've moved into a new workshop and you're sort of building it up. This is being recorded on the windiest day in 30 years, so hopefully you won't have to find roofing skills by the end of the day.
Yeah, hopefully something will be left by the end of the next 24 hours, yeah.
As I said earlier, it's a great programme to watch. It soothes it, you know, you're watching people make, you're being there with them and being on that journey. It's sad to see people go at the end of these trials, but that's the nature of that programme, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, it's awful, you know. It's really, really awful. It's, you know, I find the whole of that period, although it's joyous because you're part of this wonderful thing that you know, everybody's so invested in. Deciding who has to go home is awful. You know, it's sleepless nights and it's just horrendous.
But because it's a game that everyone's signed up to, isn't it? Yeah. Everyone knows the rules of the game.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you speak to the potters, because we all see each other, as I say, the ceramics community, it's a small community of people, so we inevitably catch up afterwards, you know. And I think, you know, any of the potters you speak to always say that they've learned something from the process, learned something about themselves or their making, their skills have progressed, you know, and that's a wonderful thing. Because, you know, when you're judging and you're sort of there, you know, you don't want it to feel like you're criticizing or, you know, somebody's endeavors, because it's just that bag of mud, like we said, you know, it's just a bag of mud. And it's only their mind and their hands that have made this amazing thing that's in front of you. So you just want to feel like you're giving sort of positive feedback that will kind of help them, you know, move their sort of processes, their work forwards, you know. It's awful, to have to decide on someone to leave. But like you say, it's the nature of the beast, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's a game that you're playing for a few weeks, or that they're playing, you know.
Absolutely.
Well, Rich, thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate you. It's been brilliant speaking to you.
Oh, no, I greatly appreciate it. It's been wonderful chatting, you know, really has. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, mate.
I just think what you do is fantastic, you know, and just so vital. You know, I listen to your podcasts anyway, so, you know, when you invited me, I was just so
excellent. So did great. You I don't suppose you listened to the Caroline Tripp one, did you?
I did I love her work. I've got a piece great, of work at home, and it's she came to our show at Farnham in November, and similarly those personal stories, and you know, I just think, it's just lovely, but dressed up in something that feels like it's of a very different place.
Exactly.
You know?
And
Carolyn, and she's lovely.
She's great.
I'm
stuff.
Really fond of her, you know. It's cool. Yeah, no, and I will continue to listen. I just think, you know, the variety that you bring and that kind of, you know, I just like the fact that you give freedom for people to talk about.
Oh, thank you, man.
What it is that motivates them, you know, because as I say, it's so important, and I just feel like it's that, you know, it's that thing that's missing sometimes, you know. It's that sort of link between people and what they're actually making, you know.
And especially where most people, creatives, are in a room on their own most of the time, aren't they, you know?
Yeah.
You need that little companion, you know, in the corner just nattering away, you know.
exactly.
All right, yeah. Rich, thank you so much for your time, mate. I'll let you get back on with your day, and I hope your roof survives tonight.
Thank you. Got everything crossed.
All the best, mate. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're unable to support us on Patreon, leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to this podcast really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast, or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Anything is appreciated, but either way, thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.